It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. 50 years ago, in 1967, the U.S. Supreme Court declared state laws against interracial marriage unconstitutional. Now, until that ruling in 1967, interracial marriages were forbidden in many states. But Iowa was not one of them. In fact, Iowa became only the second state to legalize interracial marriage a good century before the rest of the U.S. states, back in 1851. When, in 1967, the Supreme Court finally banned laws against interracial marriage in all 50 states, just 3% of newlyweds were intermarried. Since then, that number has increased fivefold. Today, one in six new marriages is mixed race. So this hour, we want to discuss that historic Supreme Court case, Loving v. Virginia, as it is known, why interracial marriages were banned in the past. And later in the hour, we'll talk with interracial couples in Iowa today to find out what challenges they've faced and still face. But first, let's start off by listening to a bit of a trailer from a 2016 film called Loving. It's a fictionalized depiction of Richard and Mildred Loving. That's the interracial couple behind that historic case, Loving v. Virginia.
Richard Perry Loving, being a white person, and Mildred Jeter, being a colored person, did unlawfully cohabitate as man and wife.
Richard?
I believe this is a battle that could go all the way to the Supreme Court.
We ain't hurt anybody.
The state of Virginia will argue that it is unfair to bring children of mixed race into the world.
Part of a trailer from a 2016 film called Loving, the depiction of Richard and Mildred Loving, the interracial couple behind that historic Loving versus Virginia case decided in 1967 by the Supreme Court. My first guest in this hour of River to River is herself in an interracial marriage. She met her husband in the early 1990s as an undergraduate at Grinnell College. Angela Onwuachi-Willig is a Charles and Marion Kirst law professor at the University of Iowa, also a chancellor's professor of law at the University of California, Berkeley, and author of According to Our Hearts, Rhinelander versus Rhinelander and the Law of the Multiracial Family. Angela, welcome back to our program.
Thank you for having me. Nice to talk to you again.
We heard this little bit of a clip from the film depiction of that case. Can you tell us what happened in the Loving v. Virginia case?
Yeah, so the Lovings were a very interesting couple. They're an African-American woman and a white man who lived in a county called Caroline County, Virginia, a county that actually had more social interaction between blacks and whites than most counties in Virginia. And they meet and they fall in love and they secretly get married. Actually, Richard knows that it's illegal to get married, but Mildred Loving does not know. She's younger. They go across state lines to Washington, D.C. They get married. They come back. They're living. Somebody must report them to the police. The police break into their house in the middle of the night and arrest them for getting married. And when they're before the trial judge says, if you leave the state for 25 years and not return, I will suspend your sentence. It's a crime in Virginia to marry across racial lines. And it's a crime also to leave to go outside of the state and to get married and come back into the state. And so the trial judge says to them, if you leave the state for 25 years and you never come back, I'll suspend your sentence. And so they leave and they go to D.C. And Mildred is just miserable. They never really get used to, she's from the country in Virginia, and they never really get used to living in the city and eventually decide they want to go back. And so she's really earnest and she writes a letter to Attorney General Kennedy at the time to see if she can get help with her case. And he refers her case to the ACLU, and they become these unlikely plaintiffs in probably the most aptly named case in U.S. history, Loving
right.
versus Virginia.
Right, right. So when this, well, first of all, what were the, in a nutshell, what were the arguments against that were brought before the Supreme Court against having interracial marriage allowed in all 50 states?
Right, so there were two claims, right? One is equal protection, so everyone's entitled to equal protection of laws, and the other one is due process. You can't deprive someone of their rights without due process of laws. And so those are the two claims the Lovings have brought before the court. And the arguments against them was that, well, look, this is not a violation of equal protection of laws. We're not treating people unequally. Blacks and whites who marry each other are punished equally. So we're not treating blacks and whites unequally by not allowing them to marry each other. And then the argument was that there was no violation of due process because a substantive due process because there was no fundamental right to enter into an interracial marriage. So those were the arguments by the other sides. And then they also sort of bring in some other arguments that are sort of not directly on point, but that have some persuasive social weight for people who are prejudiced, right? So they say, number one, this is unfair to children of interracial marriages. And before the trial court in Virginia, and actually there's a religious argument that's made that God intended for the races to be separate, and therefore this is the way that it should be. So these are the arguments that the other side presented against the Lovings. Right, mm-hmm. Mainly that there was an unequal treatment because blacks and whites were equally punished, that this was unfair to the children, that this was something mandated by God not to have interracial marriage, and that there's no fundamental right to engage in an interracial marriage.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, as you go through the arguments, let me jump to what I thought we'd talk about a little bit later, but this seems to be exactly the same arguments that were brought against same-sex marriage just within the last few years.
Yes, absolutely. These are exactly the same arguments. And if you look very closely, a lot of the parallels are almost precisely the same, right? Exactly the same arguments about no fundamental right to same-sex marriage. People were worried, made arguments about children will suffer if they are raised within a same-sex marital household, and then also made the arguments, the religious arguments as well. Yeah, exactly, precisely the same arguments were made in same-sex marriage. And actually, Mildred Loving, later on in life, becomes a real outspoken advocate for same-sex marriage and uses her own experience as a way of offering support for those who are at the time seeking to have the right to same-sex marriage validated.
In the 1960s, prior to this ruling, there were many states that had prohibition against interracial marriage. We had about 3% of the couples in the United States interracial. Now, that's a five-fold increase since 1967. About one in six new marriages, according to the information that I have. So attitudes have changed quite a bit. Take us back to what you've researched on the 1960s and before. How, you know, interracial couples, the few that existed, relatively few, 3% in the country, what they were up against, not only in terms of the law, but in society.
So they were up against sort of some of the a number of issues, right? Having problems simply finding housing, right? So there were a lot of people who would not rent to interracial couples. There were a lot of people who wouldn't rent to African Americans, but a lot of people who might have rented to African Americans who wouldn't rent to interracial couples. So there was a kind of placelessness for interracial couples during their time. Of course, there's the fear of violence, right, and being attacked. Or having one's family attacked for simply existing as two people who are in love with each other and living together. There was discrimination against people who made decisions to date or marry across racial lines, discrimination in the workplace. So people either got fired, and there's still cases today where people get fired when people discover they're married to someone of another race, or people didn't get hired at all. So all the things that you would expect, right, in a society that is openly and outwardly prejudiced happened to people who entered into interracial relationships and marriages in the 1960s.
You've written on another interracial marriage case in the book that I mentioned at the outset, According to Our Hearts, the title of the book, Rhinelander v. Rhinelander and the Law of the Multiracial Family. Tell us about that case. When did that one happen?
that case happened in the 1920s, and it happened actually in a state in New York at the time, and New York did not have a ban on interracial marriage. And it's a case where we have a wealthy white socialite who marries a woman of racially ambiguous heritage who is part African-American, and he brings an annulment claim claiming that she committed fraud by not telling him about her race or forgoing telling him about her race. And she actually defends by saying, hey, that I told you all along, you knew all along, and you married me regardless. And she actually ends up winning at trial. The interesting thing about that case, if you think about it, is that here is New York, a state that doesn't ban interracial marriage, and yet racial fraud was considered to be a legitimate basis for seeking an annulment. It wasn't ever contested as a legal basis. It shouldn't have been, given that it was legal to enter into interracial marriage. It was really a social basis for annulling a marriage that gets recognized within the legal system. And there are a number of very interesting things that the Rhinelanders experience, a number of the same things that the Lovings experience. They have a hard time finding a place to live in. In fact, he's a multimillionaire in the 1920s, and they end up living in her parents' really small, modest home in a small community in New York City, not in the kind of place that you would expect a Rhinelander to be living at that time. They end up keeping their marriage secret because they know that they will be forced apart if they tell people about their marriage. And in fact, when it's exactly what happens, once their marriage is exposed on the front page of the newspaper, his family comes and takes him away, and they basically push him to bring this case. So we see some continuity between what happens in the 1920s and what happens in the 1960s, and still we see some continuity between what happened in the 1960s and what's happening today. You still see the same kind of placelessness, given the kinds of segregation that exists in our current society.
Mm-hmm.
We still have some cases where people are fired or not hired because they married someone of a different race. Not as explicit as it was in the 1960s. And as you pointed out, there are more interracial couples than there were today than there were in the 1967 or before then. It is a little bit complicated. It is a progress narrative for this country, but if you actually get back and get underneath and look at the kinds of numbers and look at who's marrying across racial lines and who's not marrying across racial lines, it tells you a little bit about the racial hierarchy within our society.
Mm-hmm. Angela Onwuachi-Willig is my guest this half hour, talking about interracial marriage. The occasion is the 50th anniversary of Loving v. Virginia, historic case decided by the Supreme Court in 1967 that declared state laws against interracial marriage unconstitutional. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, let's talk a little bit about the attitudes, the various pairings, I guess you'd say, of interracial couples. What can you tell us about, depending on whether the man or the woman is non-white?
Yeah, so I mean, overall, whites are still the least likely group to outmarry, and among racial minorities, African Americans are the least likely group to outmarry. So one could say, and Randall Kennedy has made this argument, that tells you something about the social status or the social place of various groups in our country, and particularly African Americans versus other racial minorities. But even within the African American community, you see huge disparities in terms of outmarriage between men and women. Black men outmarry at a rate that's 2 to 3 times that of black women. And the same thing you see also with Asian American men and Asian American women. Asian American women outmarry at a rate that's about 1.5 times that of Asian American men. And so we see the ways in which particular stereotypes or perceptions of particular people at the intersection of race and sex may affect their place on the dating or marital market. Market terms. But
why do you think that is? Why are there these great disparities?
Well, there have been some studies by sociologists that have looked into these issues, and we get some sense that, for example, in terms of Asian American men, there are stereotypes that are emasculating, in terms of Asian American men, that play into whether people view Asian American men as desirable partners, right? And whereas there are stereotypes about Asian American women that fall in line that for some people who are functioning or looking at those stereotypes makes Asian American women appear to be more attractive mates than Asian American men appear to other women. Now, we also only have data basically on mainly data on heterosexual couples. If you look at gay and lesbian couples, you see most of these disparities disappear. Still, African Americans are the least likely to outmarry or outdate among same-sex couples, but there's less prejudice within same-sex couples than there is among heterosexual couples. For African American women, we know a little bit too about sort of the stereotypes that play into the perception of African American women not being attractive mates, mm-hmm. Perceptions of African American women as being domineering or too outspoken, and then also there's the beauty standard in our society, which tends to place African American women towards the lower end versus the higher end of the beauty spectrum.
Do you find that interesting that you just mentioned that when we talk about homosexual couples, gays and lesbians, that they still have prejudice? Talk about what you think about that mindset, that this group of homosexual couples, the subject of so much discrimination, would still have prejudice in their head when it comes to interracial couples.
Well, less so than heterosexual couples, but I think that, you know, it's because we all grow up. All of us are somehow infected by bias in some ways. We either internalize things or we explicitly hold particular prejudicial views. I think it's hard to grow up in society in the United States and not somehow be non-consciously, at least, affected by the kinds of things that we're led to see on TV, on the ways that we teach about our history, and the ways that we talk about each other, all the things, the ways that we respond to each other. If you look at our various communities, people internalize sort of the implicit messages that are sent through negative media images, through negative legal decisions, through a wide range of things. And so I think it would be impossible for people not to be affected by it. I think the lower percentage of prejudice among same-sex couples suggests that being a target of discrimination tends to make somebody more sensitive to the kinds of prejudice that may happen and discrimination that may happen, so that one is maybe less likely to engage in that kind of behavior on an explicit basis. But, of course, none of us are immune from that.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to ask you a little bit about your personal experience. You are African-American. Your husband is Caucasian?
Yes, that's correct.
Mm-hmm. And I understand you met your husband when you were very young, 18, in the early 1990s. You met while you were both attending Grinnell College.
Yes, that's correct.
So what was your experience in the early 90s as a mixed-race couple?
Well, I think for we had a broad range of experiences. I mean, at Grinnell College, which tends to be a more progressive place, obviously a school where there are a lot of young people. Young people tend to be, at least at that age, more open and progressive about dating across racial lines. And so from our peers, we didn't experience as much resistance. Maybe some people said things or they made jokes. It was really when we were outside of our own college community, when we might be in a different state, or we might be in the town of Grinnell, where people at that time were not as used to seeing interracial couples, where we experienced a wide variety of either subtle or not so subtle comments or actions.
So tell me about a comment or an action that you would have experienced outside of that academic setting.
Well, I think one of the things that's probably most memorable, we were in Atlanta. My husband and I visited as exchange students at Spelman College, which is historically Black women's college, and Morehouse College, which is an historically Black men's college in Atlanta. And we were walking with each other. He was walking me back from his dorm back to my dorm room, and a group of guys got out of the car and pulled us apart. And one of the guys was saying, "Well, why are you doing that? You should know better than to be dating him." And then I don't know what they were saying. They were saying similar things to him. And so that was a little bit startling because there was actual physical kind of resistance there, and we didn't know what was going to happen. I mean, pretty soon I knew that we weren't actually in danger of being physically harmed, but it was a little shocking to have people actually get out of a car, stop, and then pull us apart from each other and make comments to mm-hmm. us.
I wanted to have your reaction to some Pew Research polling done in the spring of 2017. This is also to mark that 50 years after that historic case. So in the past 7 years, in 2010 to 2017, the share of adults saying that the growing number of people marrying someone of a different race is good for society has risen 15 points just in the last seven years to 39%. And then there is also this a political divide, a sharp partisan divide in attitudes about interracial marriage, where among roughly half, 49% of Democrats and independents who lean to the Democratic Party say the growing number of people of different races marrying each other is a good thing for society, about half. In the GOP, the Republicans, only about 28% of Republicans and Republican-leaning independents share that view. What's your reaction to how much this has changed in the last 7 years and the partisan divide?
Well, my reaction is that that's good, right? That you've got more people who are willing to say that they don't, that they think that interracial marriage or interracial dating is good for our society. So, 15 point increase in the past 7 years is really important. Part of my initial reaction is to think that I would link it somewhat to the Obama effect. I think that that was an important moment for our country, and that had a pretty significant impact on people's attitudes towards interracial marriage, despite the kind of explicit racism that he experienced during his presidency. And so I think that that's good on the one hand. And on the other hand, I think, 39% is still less than 50% of Americans. And I realize that question in itself can be more complicated, but mm-hmm. that less than 50% of all Americans, not even a majority of Americans, think that interracial marriage is a good thing for our society.
Right.
And particularly at a time where people are complaining and talking about how racially divided we are, that people don't think that people making a decision to marry across racial lines signal something good about our society. So I think that's also important to highlight. The partisan divide does not surprise me. And I think it doesn't surprise me, and we can look at the most recent presidential election and just look at the way that split out to see that there are elements of the Republican Party that I think that that certain Republicans like Mitt Romney and John McCain have spoken out about that are more openly and outwardly racist than they ever have been in more recent years. And so that there would be that partisan divide does not surprise me.
Okay. Thank you very much for your time, Angela Onwuachi-Willig. She's the author of According to Our Hearts, Rhinelander versus Rhinelander and the Law of the Multiracial Family on the faculty at the University of Iowa and at the University of California in Berkeley. Angela, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
We're going to take a short break and come back as we continue to mark the anniversary of the 1967 Supreme Court decision that declared state laws against interracial marriage unconstitutional. When we come back, we'll hear from Iowans in interracial marriages about their experiences, perhaps also from you. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. And we're back midstream in this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, marking the anniversary of the landmark Supreme Court case Loving versus Virginia. 50 years ago, 1967, the U.S. Supreme Court declared state laws against interracial marriage to be unconstitutional. Now, until this ruling, interracial marriages were forbidden in many states. That's just 50 years ago. Iowa was not one of them. In fact, Iowa became the second state to legalize interracial marriage a good century before the rest of the U.S. states did, way back in 1851. Well, in 1967, when the Supreme Court finally banned laws against interracial marriage in all states, there were just 3% of newlyweds that were intermarried, so to speak. Since then, that number has increased fivefold. Today, 1 in 6 new marriages, approximately, is mixed race. So this half hour, We want to hear from you, Iowans, Midwesterners in interracial marriages, about your experiences. Tell us what you encounter that may be different from couples who are not in a mixed race or mixed ethnicity marriage. 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org is our email. You can also tweet us at IPR Talk. Joining us, first of all, Debbie and Bill Marine. They are residents of Lake City. They are in an interracial marriage. Welcome, Debbie and Bill.
Thank you.
Thank you.
How long have you been married?
We've been married since 1996, together since 1993.
Excellent. So you're over 20 years together. Tell us a little bit about how you met, how you came together.
Bill and I met out on the East Coast. He was in the military, stationed there, and I was living out there working for a publishing company. We met one day and have been together every day since then.
Mm-hmm.
She's beautiful.
Thank you.
So, Bill, when you got together and you sensed that certain feeling that, wow, mm-hmm. she's something special, Bill, did when did you think, wow, this, given our society's attitudes, may be more challenging than other marriages?
I'm originally from New Orleans, and being the melting pot that it is, I actually really didn't give that much consideration. I realize social mores may be a little bit reluctant to keep pace, but it really didn't factor into the equation at all for me.
What about you, Debbie? Did you have that thought early on in your relationship with Bill that there might be some challenges there?
I'll be honest with you. I did, in the initial phases of our relationship, wonder, how that was going to be accepted by society, my family, things like that. I'm small town Iowan. I was born and raised in Lake City, a town of 1,800. We didn't have a lot of diversity, so it was a new experience for me.
Mm-hmm. How's life in Lake City as an interracial couple? What do you encounter, perhaps, that other couples who are not interracial don't?
We moved back here after Bill got out of the military in 97, so we've been back here for 20 years, back in Iowa. I think people are curious. I think that probably we get stared at a little bit more than your average Iowa couple. I think for the most part, people are just curious and they're generally kind about it. So,
Bill, you think, is that the way you describe it? Curious?
Absolutely. I found Lake City and the surrounding communities, Rockwell City, Auburn, Lytton. I found everyone that I've had personal contact with to be just genuinely nice. If I may be trite, we're Iowa nice. Any incident that I may have had or misunderstandings, they're isolated and very, very rare. It's a positive environment.
Mm-hmm. Do you think sometimes people go overboard with being Iowa nice or friendly because you are interracial?
Sometimes you know where this is going. People say the wrong things trying to say the right thing, if that makes any sense. It's like one time, and this wasn't here in Lake City, but we were traveling up in the Dakotas, and a woman made a point to come out of a store and speak to Deborah and I, and she was asking me how we liked it, and I said, I love living up north and in the Midwest. I love cold weather. And she said, there's another guy up here. He's just like you. He says he loves cold weather too, but I told him he'll be really easy to find in the snow. So what do I do? Do I take offense at that, or do I accept it as a misguided, effort to be friendly?
Well, what did you do, Bill?
I laughed at the joke and told her to have a nice day, and, we just laughed about it.
He did what he always does. Bill is a very kind man. He's he puts people at ease. And even when, you know, I may take offense at what they say, he doesn't. He, you know, he handles himself very well in Iowa, and I'm very proud of him. Very, very proud of him.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, darling.
Thank you.
How did your respective families deal with this? Any stories there?
I was my parents are free thinkers. They raised me to think for myself. They raised me to make my own decisions, and I was initially concerned about their reaction to it, and I kept our relationship to myself for a number of months before I revealed that to my family. But they were very accepting. My immediate family was very accepting. You know, you hear a little comment every now and then from people who just, you know, they just don't quite understand. But, you know, my general family, my immediate family was very, very accepting. So
I wonder,
I'm very proud of them for that.
I wonder if you do any sort of comparison, Debbie, when you were out alone, and Bill, when you were out alone. Are you treated differently, Bill, when you're alone than when you're with your wife?
Well, that's kind of a difficult question for me to deal with, and I'll explain why, because I'm a rather large and imposing person.
Mm-hmm.
So generally, until people get to know me, or, you know, there's a, you know, interaction of some sort, it's, you know, sometimes it can be a very formal interaction with people.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Debbie, is the same true with you? Is it different?
I'm the opposite of Bill. I'm not an imposing person. I'm a small person. And I've always been able to blend into a crowd very easily. And when I started going places with Bill, it wasn't as easy. The stares that we would get from people were pretty evident and wasn't something that I was used to. That took some getting used to.
You've been married over 20 years. Have you seen? We've been referring to a new Pew Research poll that shows that a growing number of people say that marrying someone of a different race is good for society. That's risen just in the last few years. Does your experience tell you that attitudes are changing rapidly?
I wouldn't say rapidly, but attitudes are changing. Yeah.
Absolutely.
From my perspective. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, we've had moments, you know, like any couple, we've had moments when we've been out and you know, we've had things said to us that probably your average white couple wouldn't have said to them, you know, a lot of questions about where we had met, or how did we come together, and, you know, things that most people don't get asked those questions.
No.
We're just assuming a lot of things about us, assuming that because Bill's a large black man that he played football, and I met him because he played football. You know, they just assume a lot of things that, you know, that aren't necessarily true.
Well, one time we were out at dinner, and we were sitting at waiting at the bar for a table, and a gentleman sat down next to me and started talking to Deborah, and he did not make the association that we were a couple until she kissed me.
he was trying to pick me up, and I'm sitting there with my husband, and it never occurred to him that we were a couple. Never occurred to him. And so Bill leaned over and kissed me, and I'd never seen anyone move so fast in my life. He disappeared quicker than I'd ever seen.
Okay. We're talking about interracial marriage this hour, talking with Debbie and Bill Marine, an interracial couple. We'll just describe them that, because that's the context of this conversation.
Very much so.
It's 50 years since the Supreme Court declared state laws against interracial marriage to be unconstitutional. Iowa, way out in the forefront, declaring legalized interracial marriage way back in 1851. Bill and Debbie, that must make you feel good about being Iowans.
Yeah, it sure does.
You have to love Iowa.
Yeah, it sure does.
I'm very proud of my adopted state. Let me make that, you know, plain and clear. You know, couldn't have chosen a better place to relocate to, and I would, you know, And if the rest of the country is listening, you don't know what you're missing.
All right, Bill. 1-866-780-9100. If you live in a marriage, your wife or husband is a different race or ethnicity, join our conversation. 1-866-780-9100. Let's go to Rachel in Des Moines. Hi, Rachel. Does that pertain to you? Are you in an interracial marriage?
Hello. Yes, I'm in what you could describe as an interracial or intercultural marriage.
Mm-hmm.
I am white and Anglo, and my husband is mestizo and grew up in Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
So we're also a bilingual marriage.
Uh-huh. Do you have a story to tell, something to point out, how you've experienced your marriage differently?
Well, I just wanted to mention, you know, I was in the car listening to your program, and I started to tear up just listening to the history and what people were saying. We did go see Loving versus Virginia, the movie version, when it came out, and that it's something that's personal to me. And tomorrow actually is our third wedding anniversary, so it felt even more personal. And I just wanted to share that it's been the most beautiful experience of my life. And so I can assure you that, yes, interracial or intercultural, interethnicity marriage is a wonderful thing for society.
Okay, Rachel, thank you so much for your call, and congratulations in advance on your third anniversary tomorrow.
Thank you very much, and thanks for your program.
Thank you for calling in. Let's also talk to Marianne Morey, a Des Moines resident, also in an interracial marriage. Marianne, are you there?
I'm here. Thank you for having me today.
Well, welcome. Glad to have you here. I understand your husband is a Japanese citizen, and he moved to the U.S. 9 or 10 years ago?
Actually, he moved to the U.S. He first came to the U.S. as a college student, did his undergraduate mm-hmm. and graduate work here in the U.S., and then returned to Japan, and then came back to the United States to work. He's a musician. He's an orchestra conductor, and so he was teaching at LSU. And was not greeted particularly warmly there down in Louisiana.
How so?
Well, he was attacked and beaten, knocked his teeth out, left him in an alley, took his money.
Mm-hmm.
And then while he was in his home, people tried to burglarize it while he was actually inside. And that was also the same time, perhaps you remember in the news, that an exchange student from Japan went to a Halloween party and got his directions confused and ended up at the wrong house. And when he knocked on the door, the people inside shot and killed the student. So my husband had to deal with as an intermediary between the family back in Japan and the university.
Mm-hmm. And, in these incidents, you know they're tied to the fact that he is not a white American.
He strongly suspected that and, mm-hmm. yes, got that impression and was eager to leave that area.
Mm-hmm. So what is your experience here in Iowa as an interracial couple, a white American and a Japanese American citizen?
The only negative thing we've had happen is similar to what Bill and Debbie were describing when they were sitting at the bar waiting for a table and someone did not assume that they were a couple. When we dine out, so often, it's almost a majority of the time when we dine out, the server will ask, it's on a separate check. In my first marriage, I was married to a Caucasian, and I never ever had that question asked.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
if I dine out with a male white person, I'm not asked that question.
Mm-hmm.
So it's mm-hmm. obvious to me that it's because of race, and it does bother me more than it bothers my husband. I think I would probably leave a lesser tip, but my
right.
husband's very generous, and he doesn't make anything of it.
Marianne, I understand you have some daughters also in interracial marriages?
Correct. I have 6 children, and 2 of them are in interracial marriages. One is married to a Mexican citizen, and the other is married to an African American.
Mm-hmm.
So 3 of my grandchildren are biracial.
Mm-hmm. Is that a topic of family conversation quite a bit, the challenges of mixing race and marriage?
No, interestingly enough, I had not really even thought about it a lot mm-hmm. until I spoke with your producer on the phone this past week, and it caused me to ask my daughters some questions. So it really was kind of interesting to hear some stories from them that I'd not previously known about.
Mm-hmm. Marianne,
open up some good conversation.
When you go to Japan, I assume you go to Japan once in a while to your husband's
yes.
homeland.
Right.
Do you stick out there? Are you treated differently?
Oh, absolutely, we stick out because, as the Pew Research analysis showed from the census data here in the United States, female Asian Americans are more likely to intermarry than their male counterparts, and that's especially true of the Japanese citizens. In fact, I did a little research, and in 2013 data showed that it was the women who were more likely to marry a Westerner, but the men, if they were in interracial relationships in Japan, it was usually with another Asian. So we definitely stick out in Japan. We get stared at a lot, and my husband has implied that people were talking about us, although he never said what they were saying about us. But we're quite an anomaly when we go to Japan.
Mm-hmm. Marianne, Bill, and Debbie, it's interesting here when we talk about this Pew Research poll that just that came out in the spring here of 2017. In the past 7 years, the share of adults saying that the growing number of people marrying someone of a different race is good for society has risen 15 points, but risen to 39%.
Yeah.
So 39% of Americans, according to this poll, say that marrying someone of a different race is good for society. Does it seem to you like most people in this country, if we're to believe this poll, don't think your intermarriage is good for our society? Debbie? Does that surprise you, that 39%, the minority?
It does surprise me. It does surprise me. I think that's sad. Mm-hmm. think that's a, I, you know, as I was telling your producer when I talked to her earlier or late last week, I was under the impression before I met Bill that we were over a lot of things that clearly we aren't over, that have become clearer to me in the last 24 years. So I'm surprised that it's that low, and I'm discouraged by mm-hmm. that.
Bill?
No, I'm not surprised.
You're not surprised?
No, I'm not.
You sense that out there?
Given the history of our nation's poor race relations, and they have been, and it's something that we all have to work on. No, I'm really not surprised, and I'm not surprised on either side of the equation. All right, cultural differences being what they are, how you were raised, environment, everything else. I can see where there's still a lot of work to be done. Mm-hmm. I hope I live long enough to see the numbers change even more.
Marianne, what do you think of that number, that 39% of Americans think marrying someone of a different race is good for our society?
Well, I think it's as with any statistical information. I'd like to know who the people were that were surveyed. Where did they come from? What areas of the country did mm-hmm. they live in? Mm-hmm. And I think that the views differ vastly from one area of the country to another. Mm-hmm. So I would really like to be able to analyze who was surveyed. What were their backgrounds? I think if you were to ask that same question in other areas and get a different poll group, you may get a totally different number that's much higher.
And Debbie and Bill, I know you've moved around the country quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
Does it changes from region to region?
Oh, yes. Most definitely. Not only from region to region, but from country to country. Because both Deborah and I spent time over in Europe, and it was more or less, it was very, very commonplace. It seemed like it was more the norm than the exception.
Mm-hmm. We have a couple minutes left. I wanted to make sure we touched on this in the first half hour with Angela Onwuachi-Willick. But did the controversy, the division over the same-sex marriage in this country that sort of culminated several years ago, did that impact your marriage, your conversations? Did you see it differently because of your interracial marriage, Marianne?
I don't think so. We do have friends, some gay friends and lesbian friends as well. And I like to say that people are people. And I think that's how my children were raised and why some of them became involved in interracial relationships is because they know that people are people. And that's why they were very accepting, not only of my husband, but also of their own spouses.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I saw the same-sex marriage in quite the same view.
Oh, you don't think they're absolutely parallel?
I can see the similarities when you look at the Loving versus Virginia case and you read the documentation about that court case. It's very, very similar, and I can certainly understand why that case was used In the Supreme Court case about same-sex marriage, definitely.
Okay, we don't have much, less than a minute left. Debbie and Bill, did you want to get in on this note?
I guess I don't. Sorry.
So let me ask you quickly for the future, and we only have a few seconds left. Debbie and Bill, what's the future of the? Will this sort of divide over attitude about interracial marriage always exist, or will it be maybe 50 years in the future the same as eye color or hair color? I don't know.
Well, now since we're all the same species, and we are all from the Rift Valley in Africa, I think this is kind of a moot point, don't you?
All right. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Let's.
I think it's time for everyone to move on and to accept people as people and to not define someone by their color, their hair color, their skin color, their height, their weight.
All right.
Any of
we have to go. Debbie and Bill Marine, thank you. And Marianne Mori, thank you for joining us. Sorry we didn't get to the other callers we had who wanted to share their experiences. River to River River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Lindsay Moon, and Ben Stanton. Help from Helena Thompson. I'm Ben Kiefer.